Hello, and welcome to episode 5 of the Positive Thinking and the Meaning of Life podcast. My name is still Marcus Freestone. In further sorting out my writing, I found another bunch of material from a fear-busting course, which I thought I'd already used in the book or in a podcast, but I haven't, and there's loads more here, so here goes. This is all direct quotes from the journal that I wrote at the end of the course as a summary of what we'd done. But I discussed a lot of class exercises and things that happened and personal things that I haven't previously used. The talking about running away from school bullies reminded me that one of the very few times I've ever not run away from a situation was when I was 9. Somebody threatened to beat me up after school for no reason whatsoever. He simply walked past me in class and said it. This unjustness made me indignantly angry rather than scared, and I felt a rare moment of clarity and self-confidence. After school, I made sure I got out before him, put my bag down, and waited. I don't remember having a conscious plan, but I knew I would simply refuse to fight like some sort of noble pacifist. He verbally reiterated his threats and I kept silent, looking passively in his general direction in the way I imagined Gandhi may have confronted his tormentors. He punched me in the face. As he was also 9 and I was expecting it, it didn't really hurt. "This is nothing," I thought. "Why have I been so scared all these years?" The general anxiety that had been squatting in my stomach since birth took a well-deserved holiday. I didn't react at all and was gratified to see a look of confusion erupt over his face. He shoved me and shouted, "Come on then!" I continued to politely ignore him. By now, a crowd had gathered and he looked thoroughly embarrassed. One more token shove and he gave up and skulked away. Among significant murmurings from onlookers, I quietly picked up my bag and walked home. He never bothered me again, nor did anyone else in that school. Although I have used this in a few adult situations, almost as successfully as my other technique for getting away from violent people, which is to give long soliloquies about the fallaciousness of metaphysics until they back away in wild-eyed terror, this reminds me that I almost always have failed to stand up for myself as an adult and consequently now find myself in such a disempowered situation. Again, this was written about 4 years ago and I'm definitely not disempowered now. This was before I'd published any of my novels or started a proper website or anything. What I will try to do differently from now on is to remind myself that I can stand up for myself and that my life would be much better now if I did it more often. It's very pleasing to read these words 4 years on because I have definitely learnt that lesson and enact it daily. This is something we had to write about inspiration. I've only skimmed through this, so I haven't read this for a few years. This may well probably be quite negative, but hopefully it will remind me that I no longer think like this, and it may also be useful for listeners as an illustration of how they may now be thinking and to realise that you don't have to think like this at all. Under the heading inspiration, I wrote, "Unfortunately, I've rarely found anybody I've ever met inspirational. It probably only happened twice, and both of those relationships, like the majority I've ever had, ended suddenly without warning and for no reason I could perceive. They also both came with as much negative baggage as positive inspiration. Being a lifelong pessimist, I rarely find inspiration in anything. Therefore, I rarely feel inspired myself except when engaged in some form of creative work, which has become my de facto substitute for human contact. I no longer think of myself as a lifelong pessimist. I don't think of myself as a pessimist at all now. So that is the first nice reminder to get from this piece. I've always thought that the idea of meeting somebody who changes your life was an absurd Hollywood myth, but then my perceptions are fatally skewed by misanthropy. Again, not anymore, they aren't. All I ever seem to learn from people is how little I have in common with them and how little interest they have in anything I say, which just increases my deep-seated outsider complex I've been nurturing since the age of 4. Perhaps I've just always met the wrong people, but mostly I've not been inspired, just messed around, let down, and pissed off by them. In any case, I find most relationships too ephemeral to be inspiring. I no longer think like that either. Wow, this is amazing that I thought like this 4 years ago. But when I think how different my life was then, and how much worse my situations were in all sorts of ways, then I suppose it's not surprising. But this is the last time I'll interrupt myself, I promise. But it's really great. It's very positive for me to read this and realise I have left all this behind, and it was only 3 or 4 years ago. In order to be inspired by people, I suppose you have to relate to and empathise with them, which is something I have an almost autistic inability to do. I once met a man with Asperger's. Beforehand, I was told it was pointless trying to communicate with him as he was totally unresponsive. Being someone who hates just making conversation and all forms of gossip and superfluous communication, sitting alone with him in the garden, I felt uncommonly relaxed with none of my usual background anxiety. I'm quite happy to sit in silence and engage with my own mind for hours. I didn't try to start a conversation, but he soon began talking to me. It wasn't a lengthy exchange, but he demonstrated an understanding of and interest in what I'd been doing that day. Afterwards, my psychotherapist friend, who'd known him for 20 years, said, "That's one of the most involved conversations I've ever heard him have. He must really like you." Personally, I found the conversation and his behaviour throughout the day perfectly normal and more honest than most. I would never have guessed he had Asperger's. To me, it's people who chatter on inconsequentially that should be labelled defective. Clearly, I should try befriending lots of autistic people. I do find looking up at the night sky inspiring. It gives me a sense of communion with all the scientists and philosophers who previously studied it, a communion I almost never feel with anyone I meet. In fact, I've recently stuck a photo of the Earth taken from space on my bedroom wall. I look at it every day to remind me to keep my life in perspective. There's no point getting stressed out and depressed about the trivialities of a species existing at random on a tiny lump of rock in an infinity of purposeless space-time. The universe and human existence is neither meaningful nor meaningless. They just are. In my own twisted way, that's my inspiration. The existential futility of life, on a good day, motivates me to try harder to obtain the life I want, because this brief candle is all we have, so we must make the most of it. To the same end, I've put a welcome message on my phone that reads, "Don't waste any more days of my life," which serves the same purpose as the photo. It is when I lose this perspective and become hubristically convinced that what I do matters to anyone but myself that I become depressed. I find it difficult enough to relate to and therefore learn from my own experience, never mind anyone else's. Consciousness to me has always seemed a random jumble of sensory input, and the behaviour of the human race akin to that of a nest of confused ants, constantly dodging a boiling kettle. I suppose, therefore, that I don't find inspiration in people because I neither expect nor look for it. Our personality and attitudes are formed in early life when we have no control over our circumstances. I received no inspiration or encouragement from anyone back then, and consequently don't expect to now. On the rare occasions I read about someone inspiring, I always think, "That's great, but I could never do that." If I'm ever in need of inspiration, I have to dredge the slim pickings of my own well. That's pretty powerful reading that. I disagree with almost all of it now, which shows how much I've moved on. That really is fantastic. I have moved on from this, but this is something I think that I still have a problem with, and I'm sure lots of people listening will as well. The idea of, or rather the problem of, feeling alienated from things that other people seem to take seriously and you think this is ridiculous. Again, I think it's a kind of hubris or maybe some sort of superiority complex. But this is an excerpt from week three of the course. We had an early break during which I stayed in the room and witnessed a conversation between everyone else in the room about reality television. I don't watch TV at all, and all those shows are anathema to me, so I had nothing to contribute, but nevertheless I felt excluded and invisible. Rather than leaving the room or speaking up, I sat there and seethed inwardly. I scribbled vitriolically in my exercise book, "Am I ever going to meet anybody I have anything in common with? To these people I'm an alien." I'd been very depressed for a few days anyway, otherwise I wouldn't have had such an extreme reaction. After the break, we watched a video of a dying man talking about life. I didn't empathise with it at all. I just found it sickly and cloying, especially the audience reactions, which were very American. It wasn't just my depressed state. I would have always had this reaction. I'm just not an emotional sort of person, and I never feel connected to other human beings on anything but a superficial level. I also couldn't understand the story of the woman crying at seeing a blind man. I don't think that's empathy. I think it's disgustingly patronising, and I find the idea of someone else's misfortune making you feel better to be utterly repulsive. Well, as I said there, I was very depressed during that, but I so obviously my perception was massively skewed, but I do still find that listening to a podcast or something, or reading something or hearing something on the news when I don't manage to avoid it, something that really has nothing to do with me, just annoys me and makes me angry for no particular reason. It's as if there's still this negative part of my brain that is searching out for things to become annoyed at. And whenever it finds something with the slightest thread that it knows will annoy me, it kicks off and makes me angry. I think that's the mechanism that's going on in my head, rather than any actual intellectual decision, any conscious decision that this comment is deserving of my anger. I've only just thought of that. That's actually quite liberating. The idea that there's this sort of, as Colin Wilson and Gurdjieff and Ouspensky, whom I'll be talking a lot about, I think, in the next episode, as they would say, the subconscious robot, part of it will work against us sometimes. And I think that's what's going on there. And you need to recognise that process in order to break the negative cycle. This is from the next bit of the journal, the following week's class. And this, again, is very personal. But I find this kind of inspiring now, as this was this doing this course at the very start of my growth and coming out of about 5 or 6 years of living like a hermit and hardly ever having any human conversation. I really wasn't looking forward to this week's class because I was feeling so alienated from everybody from what happened the previous week. I'd also been feeling alienated by people's talk of owning cars and houses and having holidays, from which I've always been excluded. It therefore came as a great surprise to me that I really enjoyed this class and even began to feel a sense of communion with the others. Hearing about their lives in more detail made me realise that I do have things in common with them after all. Somebody mentioned that they hated working in an open plan office. That was one of the things I hated most about my last job. Even though you could wear headphones, I still felt painfully exposed. During the break, I went out for a quick cigarette and then went into the canteen. Being me, I took a chair at the table next to everyone else and prepared myself for the depressing feeling of once again being on the outside of the group, looking in resentfully and feeling the awkward anxiety and social isolation of 30 years ago that has never entirely left me. Before I could sit down and alienate myself, everyone moved aside and invited me into the group. I was so surprised I almost dropped to the chair, but I soon joined in the conversation. This sounds insignificant, but it meant a great deal to me after 5 years of living as a hermit, and I was pathetically grateful. After the break, I talked about some of my fears and found I was enjoying talking to people, something I've almost forgotten how to do. For me, it was akin to group therapy, something I've always decried as Californian nonsense. On the way out, I was behind someone and I thought, I've never really talked to him, I should. I had the usual negative thoughts of, oh, well, it's too late now, he won't be interested, etc. But unusually, I took the leap and initiated a conversation. We talked for 10 minutes about Buddhism and many other things. I haven't had anyone to talk to about these sort of things for years, and it was a welcome relief. This week, I learned a massively important lesson. Most of my alienation from people comes from my own actions and my pathetic reticence to initiate social interactions. I took a huge plunge tonight and it paid off. From now on, I will assume people want to talk to me unless they demonstrate otherwise, rather than assuming from the start that everyone dislikes me or finds me weird and hard to talk to. This week, we broke into two groups to discuss five truths, which I really enjoyed, although the truths are all highly subjective. Most of the conversation went off at tangents, but that was probably due to my contributions. I actually disagreed with most of the truths, and so obviously won't be applying them to my own life. 1. You can grow in a direction you're happy with and not experience fear. In my opinion, the two are mutually exclusive, and moreover, I think this is a very negative, discouraging statement for something that's supposed to be therapeutic. I'm not sure how I feel about that now, 4 years on. You can grow in a direction you're happy with and not experience fear. Well, yeah, actually, I was being very negative at the time. Yeah, of course you can, but it doesn't mean you necessarily will. But I suppose that is kind of a positive affirmation that you can grow in a direction you're happy with without experiencing fear. So actually, yes. No, I agree with that. That I guess my better wording of it would be, you can grow in a direction you're happy with and not necessarily experience fear. In other words, change and growth is not always a fearful process. So slightly reworded, I now agree with that. So that's something else more positive. 2, confronting something may not cure the fear. You may become even more afraid, but it is better than cowering at home and avoiding the problem. Yes, I would agree with that. That last bit was my own conclusion. That's all I've written about that. Again, I haven't actually got these five truths, but it's pretty obvious what they are. It's about confronting things and fear. So it's pretty obvious from my answers what these truths were. 3, confronting something also makes you less likely to cop out next time you face a challenge. We have evolved to seek out predictability, and thus our lives are a series of repeating patterns. We will react in the same way again and again to a similar situation unless we consciously break the cycle. I definitely agree with that now. 4, not everything unfamiliar makes you afraid. Again, fear and newness are mutually exclusive. This is also a negative statement which discourages growth. Okay, that's my reference to the statement, which, again, I can't remember what it is, but that's me putting a more positive spin on it. 5, confronting a fear is always far less hassle than avoiding it. You can avoid things in perpetuity, so the fear will never leave you. Yes, I definitely agree with that. I spent many years not confronting my fears, and they never went away. You just have to dive in and do it. And 99.9% of the time, you find that the fear was illusory and that you can do the thing easily and nothing bad happens. It's entirely positive. It's like the thing about exercise. Once you've got your shoes on and got out the front door, you can go for a nice walk or a jog or whatever. But it's actually crowbarring yourself off the sofa or out of bed in the first place. That's 90% of the battle. And it's the same with confronting fears. You just have to make that initial first commitment. I had a very positive outcome from this discussion. I remembered that I have successfully overcome many fears in the past. In fact, every time I have confronted a fear, I have overcome it. School bullying, my first job, breaking off an engagement, performing stand-up comedy, teaching and lecturing. I faced up to and mastered my fear of all of them. What I will remember from this session is that nowadays I more often than not fail to confront my fears and problems. I have trained myself to retreat into my shell. I will do my utmost to stop retreating in future. I will also remember that I do not fear new situations. I look forward to and embrace them. And 4 years on, I can definitely say that I have inculcated this practice into my life. So, more positivity. Brilliant. Many people in the class seem to have been genuinely terrified at the prospect of doing this course. I'm a deeply shy, neurotic person, but I can't understand how anyone can fear an evening class, which is entirely voluntary. I will try to remind myself that I can easily do, in fact, greatly enjoy, things that clearly terrify a majority of people. This is a major achievement for me, which I usually don't give myself credit for and forget about. I need to constantly remind myself that I'm good at things and I'm fairly accomplished, despite my current straitened circumstances and the impression I clearly give to people. And then the following week, I faced a great personal challenge this week and have acquitted myself unusually well. I was very taken aback during our group discussion when somebody said, "You're a very negative person, aren't you?" I've never been happier than during the last year or so, but I kind of proved her point by giving a very negative answer along the lines of, "If you think I'm negative now, you should have seen me a few years ago." I was profoundly angry with myself afterwards because I lacked the confidence to challenge her false statement. This is the sort of self-defeating reaction I would have had as a child and thought I had eradicated. Although I'm now more positive than I've ever been and I'm happy and calm 80 to 90% of the time, I clearly in some manner exude an air of negativity. 4 years on, I do still exude an air of negativity, but only on rare, short-lasting occasions. So that is a huge progress compared to how I used to be. I mentioned my fear of flying, which I've never done, and everyone immediately told me how much I was missing out on, all the great places they'd been to, how wrong I was about everything, and somehow implied that I was letting myself down by not travelling abroad. I felt under attack and felt like crying and telling them to fuck off, but I kept my composure and skillfully changed the subject. Even 6 months ago, I would have brooded on this for days, maybe even given up the class, but within 30 seconds, I felt totally calm again and forgot all about it. I am very proud of myself for overcoming this so well. This is the first time I've reacted so well to something like this. This reminded me that all year I've been getting better and stronger at dealing with everything that comes my way. Most people in my circumstances would be far less positive and happy than I am. What I learned from this episode is that although I rarely think negatively, I'm still acting negatively, and that's how people judge me on external appearances. It's as if the part of my brain that deals with communication and presenting a front to the world hasn't caught up yet. Because I'm so out of practice at dealing with people, I'm returning to past defaults. Plus, I haven't overwritten my scripts about how people perceive me. I've also come out of this session with a very strong and positive bolster to my self-confidence. Disagreeing with a statement or group opinion is not an inherently negative stance, even if some people choose to perceive it in that way. I have an analytical, scientific, and empirical approach to life. and I will not apologise for this in the face of people thinking I should not be this way. I've been thinking about meditating for ages. I used to do it twice a week, but haven't got around to it. I really enjoyed the hypnotherapy, that's basically a kind of meditation that we did in class, which was basically a guided meditation. And before writing this, I dug out my old tape of meditation music and spent a very pleasant 40 minutes reinforcing my new positivity. And this is the last couple of pages from this journal. We began this week by writing a list of things that were great and not so great in our lives. We only had 5 minutes, and I would have liked 15 to do this more thoroughly, but I still got a lot out of it. Principally, a realization that there really isn't anything that terrible in my life, and nothing I can't overcome with determination and a smidgen of luck. As a result of this, I will try to keep in mind that there is much more about my current life that I love than aspects I hate. Then we had to write about how somebody close sees us. I don't have any family, so I could only choose a friend. I couldn't really do this exercise as I'm psychologically incapable of imagining how anyone else thinks. I think it's an impossible task, but most people falsely think they can genuinely see things from another's perspective. The one thing above all else I've learned in my life is the unbridgeable chasm between what we say and what we think. Human consciousness evolved long before language, and therefore our innermost thoughts and feelings are independent of language, which is why we have so much trouble expressing our feelings. Even when I'm concentrating very hard on getting a particular point across to somebody, I'm always aware of and frustrated by my inability to accurately transcribe what's in my head. I think much of human communication is futile because all parties just go on thinking what they were thinking before because they haven't understood the other person. Anyway, I ended up doing something slightly different but still useful to me, which was to examine how I behave when I'm with my best friend. I realised that I often go off on a rant for no reason at all and can be very argumentative at times. I also think I'm rather distant and cold towards him at times. I've never realised this before and will look out for this in the future. That's something I have definitely worked on with that person in particular and people in general. We also had to write about the impression we wanted to leave on the world. I really don't care. In fact, I've been looking into the legal business of not having any sort of funeral service because I want my death to be free of hypocrisy. For the sake of the exercise, I came up with the epitaph. He grew out of a random assortment of carbon atoms, and now they are disassembling and floating away back into the universe. In between, he had many faults, but hubristically and anthropomorphically believing that the universe took any notice of him wasn't one of them. Boy, that's a lot more sarcastic and negative than I would choose to be today. We then talked about positive affirmations. I've done something similar before whereby you reprogram your subconscious using auto-suggestion, which I detailed in the book. I found it very useful, but this reminded me that I haven't done anything like this for a long time, and have in fact been sliding back into negative affirmations. We were given post-it notes to write down some of our own. I've stuck them around my house, including, other people's opinions do not affect my state of mind or life choices. Hopefully they'll serve the same function as the photo of the earth on my bedroom wall and the welcome message on my phone. I found all these exercises very useful, and they reminded me that I'm actually by nature a very positive, imaginative, ambitious person, and that the depressive side of me is the aberration, not the real me. I feel that this course has been like taking a long hot bath in positive ideas. I currently don't feel I need to do anything differently because I'm being so positive and adventurous. And the final section. This week we watched a long excerpt from a DVD called The Secret. I could barely contain my incredulity that we were being subjected to this anti-science, anti-logic, anthropomorphic nonsense and scribbled 3 pages of notes during the initial viewing. To me it was deeply off-putting and unempowering and had all the appearance of a cult or a pyramid scheme. It also seemed to focus almost entirely on material acquisition, the American dream. One man talked about his $4 million house, and I couldn't help thinking that that's obscene, Nobody needs a $4 million house. How vacuous he must be to be so proud of it. And that he has this house because millions of gullible people have bought his book and DVD. The reason that kid got the bike for Christmas was because his parents went to a shop and bought it, not because he sent out positive energy to the universe. It reminded me of something from a couple of years ago I actually found deeply worrying. Someone who was my close friend at the time, despite long-standing problems I've had with him, not least that he once tried to get me sectioned, had written out some affirmations and put them on his living room wall. He would meditate in front of them. They read, "I want £2 million," and "Thank you for my £2 million. He actually thought that meditating in front of these words would somehow make him acquire the money. When I pointed out the fact that these words had no influence on anything but his own state of mind, that he wasn't actually doing anything in the physical world to bring about this event, and that in any case, his life wouldn't change significantly even if he did have the money, he became very defensive, started avoiding me, and our 16-year friendship ground to a halt. I have no evidence to suggest his delusions or his circumstances have changed. This metaphysical chicanery makes me very angry, but on a personal level, I was extremely pleased with myself for how well I moderated my comments and stuck to my guns. I was also pleased to find that during the break, other people agreed with my assessment. Overall, though, and this is a very positive thing for me, I just found it laughable rather than annoying, and it increased my self-confidence because I just don't need to resort to this sort of rubbish, nor to justify my opinions of it. Later, we were asked to write about what do I really want. I was delighted to discover that nothing I want is unattainable. The first thing that came to my mind was, I want peace of mind, freedom from stress and anxiety, and a relief from my current financial circumstances. I want to live a creative, intellectual life, meet new people, and collaborate on creative ventures with them. I'm well on my way to achieving these ambitions, and have made great progress during the last few weeks with my adventurous new attitude. I was very happy to share with the class my recent adventures of meeting one of my favourite bands. I think it is more likely than not that most of my ambitions will come true during the next year or two. For somebody with such a history of depression, failure and self-hatred as myself, this is an overwhelming and joyous state of mind to be experiencing. And that's that, folks. Well, that is absolutely and definitely all that I have from my course journals on relevant subjects to positive thinking and meaning of life. Next week's episode is either going to be about the dangers of nihilism, or it's going to be about Colin Wilson and Gurdjieff and Ouspensky. I haven't decided that yet, but whatever it is, it will be positive and it will have meaning. Now go back to your constituencies and be happy. See you next time. Bye.